This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. Today, National Rural Reporter Kath Sullivan will be along in just a few moments' time just to talk about how the National Party federally might look under the new leader, David Littleproud. What do you make of the spill and the fact that David Littleproud has knocked Barnaby Joyce out of the top job? Let me know on the text. Was it time for a change or not? 0448 922 604 to text through and be part of the conversation on the Country Hour today. And also, you're going to be spending some time on the Abrolhos Islands, just off the WA coast from Geraldton, where some unique coral is being farmed for aquariums right across the country.
There are thousands of people around Australia that love doing their aquariums in their own home and have such a passion that they will spend lots of money to be able to have that in their own home.
First stop today, though, is the Pilbara, where pastoralists are hopeful more rain over the next few days will trigger season-changing pasture growth on their properties. Mark Bettini runs to Grey Station, which is about 100 kilometres east of Port Hedland, where about 40 millimetres of rain fell yesterday. Mark says it was much needed, and he's got his fingers crossed there's more on the way.
It's nice not to have to worry about water runs at this stage for the next little while. If it stopped now, it would make a lot of difference. But if it keeps getting and we get, you know, 3 or 4 inches, it'll make a huge difference to the year going forward. It was looking very dry, and we were, you know, going to have to early wean calves and, you know, send a lot of cattle off the property that would normally stay here, such as weaners and those sort of things. So this just gives us a bit of a chance to reset and have a look at that. I'm sure we still won't get the normal pasture growth that we would if we had rain during the summer, but it'll certainly make a fair bit of difference, and it's a bit of a relief, to tell you the truth.
What changes will you look at making now with this rainfall?
Probably won't muster for about 10 days. I'll let it dry out. And yeah, look at what we can do as far as, you know, maybe not marketing any of our cattle for a little bit, just to let them fatten up and finish up here rather than taking them away on adjustment. But we'll just have to see how much rain we get and see how much grass grows and take it from there. We've been mustering the previous week, and we had a lot of cattle in the yards yesterday, and we had to get them all processed and out into paddocks again. So the whole crew are working pretty hard up until dark last night to get all the preparations for this rain. So we're all having a day off today, fiddling our thumbs watching it rain.
Probably well earned, I imagine. If you could put in an order, how much would you be hoping for in the next few days?
Oh, as much as we can have. Within reason, but, you know, you've just got to take what you get. Look, if we got another inch, that'd be fantastic. If we got another three, that'd be nice too, but we don't want to be greedy.
De Grey Station owner Mark Bettini with Steph Sinclair. Now, the average annual rainfall at De Grey is about 340 millimetres, and the falls over the weekend take this year's total to about 105 mils. So, checking in with the details, the rainfall details, just after 12:30 today, Richard Hudson will be along going through the rain that's fallen already, and hopefully he'll be kept busy over the next few days with some more rain in that patch too. This is the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia. It is 12:08. And as I mentioned just a few moments ago, Queensland MP David Littleproud has been elected as the leader of the Nationals federally, with New South Wales Senator Perrin Davey elected deputy. David Littleproud defeated the incumbent leader Barnaby Joyce and former Minister Darren Chester in a three-way leadership contest. Kath Sullivan is the ABC's National Rural Reporter. Kath, how did David Littleproud react to the news that he's now leading the party?
Well, Belinda, he actually said this was the proudest day in his political career, and he was obviously personally touched to have had the backing of his party room, which has appointed him the leader as the coalition heads into opposition for the next 3 years. We, of course, would know on the Country Hour David Littleproud as the former agriculture minister when the coalition was in government. He stood out for a couple of reasons in that portfolio, really trying to set up two legacy items, I guess you would say, one being the agriculture visa, which was meant to bring workers from foreign countries into Australia to work across fisheries, forestry, and agriculture. Now, as you know, no worker has arrived on that visa yet, and it could look very different under the incoming Labor government. The other, feather in David Littleproud's cap, or at least that's what he hoped it would be, was the biodiversity scheme, in which he was really working to set up a market that would see farmers rewarded for boosting biodiversity on their farms. So if you built a habitat pathway so that wildlife could be able to have homes and travel through agricultural property, he really thought that farmers should be rewarded for that and that they should be able to make a supplementary income in some ways by doing that.
This just in on the text from Michael, who says this is a really good move by the Nationals. You can be part of the conversation too. 0448 922 604 is the text. What's been the response from Barnaby Joyce, Kath?
Okay, well, we've just had a written statement from Barnaby Joyce not too long ago, and it actually said that you probably think I'm sad, but I'm not really. Barnaby Joyce, who actually lost the leadership of the Nationals twice, I was reminded this morning, once when he had to leave the parliament over the citizenship, we'll call it a scandal, when a number of MPs and senators actually left the parliament due to a dual citizenship. That wasn't very too long that he was out in the cold. He was very quickly re-elected in a by-election in his New South Wales seat of New England and restored as the Nationals leader and deputy prime minister. He then stood down in 2018. He said to clear the air, and that was when Malcolm Turnbull was the Prime Minister and there were allegations of sexual harassment, and it just became public that he, his partner and he were expecting a baby, that former staffer Vicky Campion. So he has been here before, but you get the sense that Barnaby Joyce is looking forward to representing his electorate of New England. And I don't think anyone would ever write him off, given that we've seen so many comebacks before.
Why do you think the party voted for change at the top, despite the fact that it managed to keep all of its lower house seats at the election?
Okay, well, there are really two narratives going into today's leadership ballot. One is that Barnaby Joyce did a great job, ensured that the party's members held all 16 lower house seats. Anthony Albanese and Scott Morrison certainly couldn't say that they hadn't lost seats. Said that he'd managed to get a good deal for regional Australia out of the net zero by 2050 commitment. You'll recall this is a commitment that's not legislated, that the Nationals really did drag the chain on before Scott Morrison headed off to tell the rest of the world about where Australia stood on climate policy. We saw something like $20 billion worth of announceables in this year's federal budget, which is pretty remarkable. But then the other story heading into today's debate was that the coalition, the Nationals in coalition, were responsible for part of the defeat, seeing inner city Liberals get wiped off the electoral map. I think it's been chewed over quite a bit by now that there were teal independents campaigning on this suggestion that a vote for Josh Frydenberg or Trent Zimmerman was in fact a vote for Barnaby Joyce, who at the time of that net zero deal told the party room, you know what, I don't personally support this idea. I don't think we should be going to net zero. Of course, he went with the majority of the room and they did back in the deal. But even since last week's election result, Belinda, we've heard from his close confidant, the Queensland Senator Matt Canavan, that he thinks that net zero was a failed agenda and doesn't think that it was an election issue. So climate is something that has well and truly divided the party, and building on that latter story, we heard from Michael McCormack, former Nationals leader, who basically got the heave-ho because Barnaby Joyce resought the leadership again over climate policy last June. He was quick out of the gates to say these results, we wouldn't have seen these results, in which many Nationals MPs suffered swings against them. I think more than half had a swing against them. He said that simply wouldn't have happened under his leadership. And we quickly heard from the Victorian MP, Darren Chester, that he thought the Nats really needed to take some accountability for that coalition loss.
This on the text from Francis, who says, the federal Nats keep all their seats. The leader gets replaced. WA Nats keep losing seats in WA elections and only get one candidate for Canberra, and they still keep their leader. I'll go vote for another mob now, says Francis. And Kath, another change too. Peter Dutton has been elected unopposed as the Liberal Party's new leader at a meeting in Canberra this morning.
That's right. Two Queenslanders are heading up the coalition in opposition, and two New South Wales women, in fact, both from the southern part of New South Wales, the Riverina, where the Murray-Darling Basin is a huge policy, have taken up those deputy roles. For the Liberal Party, it will be Susan Lee, a former Environment Minister, who you might recall famously spoke out against the live export of sheep when she was on the backbench last, I think it was. I just thought that was an interesting thing to point out, given we've now got Labor committing to phase out live sheep exports. And for the Nationals, it will be Senator Perrin Davey, a first-term senator who is also known for speaking out on Murray-Darling Basin issues, who will be the deputy for the Nationals in opposition.
Kath, thank you so much for fleshing out those details. Appreciate it.
I hope I helped. Thanks, Belle.
National Rural Reporter Kath Sullivan, just with the news today that the Queensland MP, David Littleproud, has been elected as leader of the Nationals federally, with New South Wales Senator Perrin Davey elected deputy leader. 16 past 12.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Great to have you along this afternoon. An update from the newsroom at 12:30. Then checking weather conditions right around the state with a cross to the bomb. First, though, car makers are calling on the new Australian government to set a vehicle emissions standard. Tony Webber is head of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, which represents all the major vehicle manufacturers in the Australian market. He says this is well overdue for the environment, and without better fuel, Australia won't see the best quality internal combustion engines.
So Australia has the lowest quality petrol in the OECD. We currently are one of only two nations in the world, advanced nations that is, without a CO2 standard, the other nation being Russia. So we're not in particularly good company there.
Why is that the case? How is it that other countries have been able to establish better quality fuel than we do? And what does that actually mean for the vehicles out on the road today?
We have low quality fuel because of the two remaining refineries doesn't have the capacity at the moment because of a lack of capital investment to actually produce high quality world-class fuel.
So what does it mean for the emissions, both in terms of greenhouse emissions and air quality that comes out of the exhaust?
Well, you get inferior outcomes in both greenhouse emissions and air quality with low quality fuel, and that's one of the great problems. And the other issue that we have is the research and development that is being undertaken around the world for improving internal combustion engines, and the industry spends about $125 billion US per annum on R&D. All that work that is going into more fuel efficient, higher performing internal combustion engines is not being undertaken on the basis of supplying low-quality fuel like we have in Australia. Some of the best high-quality internal combustion engines cannot run on Australia's 91 RON fuel, so therefore those engines are not always brought to this market, and that's a great shame.
What suggestions will you be taking to the new federal government in order to remedy that?
Well, there's two really important factors here. Number one is to improve the fuel quality in Australia, and that means investment in the two remaining refineries. The second issue that we need to address is having a CO2 target, because a CO2 target means we will bring to this country the most fuel efficient, low emissions environment vehicles that are available around the world, because they will be mandated by the government, and that sends a market signal to producers right around the world that the best quality, low emission vehicles need to be sent to Australia. And that's why we have introduced in 2020 our voluntary CO2 target, and we now are seeking the Commonwealth Government to implement that and mandate it as part of their policy package.
Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries Chief Executive Tony Webber with Angus McIntosh. And the Albanese government has pledged to reduce national greenhouse emissions by 43% by 2030. 19 past 12. Australia's gold production fell by 6% in the March quarter, mainly due to COVID outbreaks and wet weather. National production was 76 tonnes. That's down from 81 tonnes in the December quarter. But gold mining analyst Dr. Sandra Close says under the circumstances, Australia has still done quite well.
COVID was certainly one of the big ones, and with WA having been closed down for so long, 697 days it was that the WA border was closed, and the gold sector did very well, but it sure is biting now, and COVID is affecting a lot of production both in WA and also elsewhere in New South Wales and in Queensland, as well as the wet weather.
You've noted in your report some of the major companies that got affected. There was Westgold Resources with the equivalent of 320 shifts between late February and late March lost due to COVID. So that's one of the big ones. But you've noted there was a few others that went through similar scenarios.
Yes, the Westgold one at 320 shifts sure was bad news, but also Evolution in their Carol operation in New South Wales, 25% of its workers tested positive for COVID, so you can imagine how that affected them, plus rainfall, and Oz Minerals particularly had wet weather in South Australia, and various other ones, St Ives, Granny Smith, Tanami, and even Boddington, they were all down. There are others as well, but we didn't give an exhaustive list or it'd be too long.
Dr. Sandra Close, she is the director of gold mining consultancy Surbiton, and she was speaking to Jared Lucas about the impact of COVID and seasonal rains on Australia's gold production in the March quarter. 21 past 12. Australia's chief veterinary officer, Mark Shipp, and Deputy Chief Vet Beth Cookson are both visiting Indonesia to meet with senior government officials and discuss animal health and biosecurity cooperation. Dr. Shipp says the recent detection of foot and mouth disease in Indonesia and the earlier outbreak of lumpy skin disease on the island of Sumatra just highlights the increasing animal disease risks in our region and the importance of biosecurity cooperation to protect Australia. As you know, FMD, it's a contagious viral disease that's found in cattle, sheep, goats and pigs with severe consequences for animal health and also agricultural trade. The two vets are going to be meeting with senior officials at Indonesia's Ministry of Agriculture to talk about LSD and FMD outbreaks in Indonesia, and with the head of the Indonesian Office of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United States. The visit is all about strengthening those relationships in Indonesia and sharing on-the-ground knowledge to help better protect Australia from these sorts of exotic pest and disease threats. Meanwhile, a leading livestock analyst is calling for a three-month ban on flights to Indonesia until an outbreak of foot and mouth disease in the country is under control. Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends says the so-called barley ban would lower the risk to Australian producers.
I think that we need to review travel from barley into Australia, and given the spreading of foot and mouth disease and lumpy skin disease across the whole of Indonesia now, it really does raise the question about biosecurity and potentially the highways of foot and mouth disease we're creating into our major airports of Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney.
So you think there should be a ban on flights to Indonesia? Is that what you're calling for?
I think I would at least like to think about a moratorium for 3 months or thereabouts while, you might say, they get their backyard sorted in Indonesia. So with that is the need for vaccines. And that's part of the challenge right now, is that we know it's now spread right across Sumatra, Central, East and West Java, Lombok. It's throughout the whole of Indonesia, and we know anecdotally that barley is right there, and it's the pigs in Bali, the 900,000 head, that's the real concern because they're super spreaders.
A moratorium on flights would mean effectively stopping the tourism trade to Bali being a hotspot for Australian tourists. It sounds like a big call to make to be calling for this. Does it feel like that to you?
No, it just feels like common sense.
Do you think it's common sense? Do you like that idea to try and protect Australia from foot and mouth disease coming into this country? Just have that 3-month ban on flights to Indonesia. Oh, that might upset your upcoming Bali trip, perhaps. What do you think of the idea? Let me know on text 0448 922 604. Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends thinks it's a good idea, and he was talking to Warwick Long. 25 past 12, nearly time to head to the newsroom for an update. Just before that, though, heading to Carnarvon, where Carnarvon's Sweeter Banana Cooperative wants to establish Western Australia's first frozen banana products. To help it buy the necessary equipment, the state government has just given the cooperative an $800,000 loan. Sweeter Banana business manager Doriana Mangeli says this is their first step in value adding and making money out of second grade fruit that normally goes to waste.
Currently, all the bananas that are frozen bananas that are used in food processing in Western Australia are imported either from the eastern states or from overseas. So it'll be great to get a locally grown product that can supply. And we've seen, you know, the last couple of years been really tricky with supply chain issues, lack of shipping, and this gives Western Australian food processors security as well, because you've got a local supply just up the road, not waiting for things to come in from Vietnam and other countries. And it just seems crazy to me that we are importing frozen bananas from other countries whilst here in Carnarvon we're throwing out perfectly good edible bananas that could be utilised in Western Australia. So it just seems, you know, like a crazy waste of the planet's resources, really.
So you've just been given this loan from the government. What does this mean for your business, and how are you going to use it?
So the cooperative loan is going to help us to purchase our current packing shed, which we've been operating in for 20 years and renting. And we're also using the funds to invest in a value-adding facility, which will enable us to do something with all of our waste bananas rather than throwing them out, doing some ripening and some freezing.
And how will this boost profits?
We will be able to give a return back to our members for fruit that we're currently throwing out. So the amount of money and energy and natural resources that goes into growing a banana, to have it then come out at the end of that growing process to be thrown into the waste truck to be used as mulch. It costs the same amount to grow that banana as it does to grow a banana that people are eating at home. So if we can do something with that fruit and get a return back to our members, it's going to make the whole business more sustainable.
And how is business looking, and how are you hoping to expand in the next 10 years?
It's been a really great year for volume. Not such a great year for pricing. And obviously, like everybody, we've had all the supply chain issues and challenges and increased costs of all our inputs. So we hope that's sort of stabilised now. It's been a bit of a shock the last 2 years. But, you know, in 10 years, ideally, we would be producing many value-add products. We wouldn't have a single waste banana, and we would be making sure that every single banana that we grew was being eaten in one form or another. So the value-adding facility, freezing bananas and replacing the imported frozen bananas, I think is just the first step. And once we've got that underway, I see many opportunities for us to be doing a lot of food processing and reducing waste, and making sure that growers are paid for every single banana that they're growing.
And how significant is this loan to the future of your cooperative?
It's definitely the next step. So we've been in the packing shed for 20 years. We've been a cooperative for 20 years. And this is going to take us to the next level of securing a future for the cooperative. So we'll be able to continue enjoying Carnarvon bananas for many years to come. So we've got that security in that we own the building, and that we will be able to keep packing, processing, and it gives a future for Carnarvon bananas, something that means that we'll go on beyond all the existing members onto to the next members, so we'll have a future industry.
And how do the growers and other members of your cooperative feel about this loan?
So this is something we've been planning for a long time, the purchase of the packing shed, and the cooperative loan is a facility that we've used before, so everyone sort of understands the benefits of it. And it's a great one because there's no risk to the taxpayer, the bank fully underwrites it, and we pay all the interest and repay the loan. So it's a way of government supporting in a way that doesn't impact on the bottom line for the taxpayer.
Doriana Mangeli, business manager of Sweeter Banana Cooperative, speaking to Sophie Johnson about how they've just secured this $800,000 loan to help them set up the infrastructure that's needed to freeze their bananas. And that loan is through the State Government Cooperative Loan Scheme, and it will help the co-op produce WA's first frozen banana product. It is 12:30. Jonathan Beale is here. What's making the headlines, Jonathan?
In the headlines, Belinda, the new federal Liberal leader, Peter Dutton, has vowed to bring strength of character and relentless resolve to the position. As expected, the Queensland MP was elected unopposed as new leader at a meeting in Canberra today. Susan Lee was elected deputy. David Littleproud has been elected Nationals leader, replacing Barnaby Joyce. Mr. Dutton, has a conservative and hardline reputation, but he's sought to reshape his image in recent days as he faces the task of uniting and rebuilding the party following its election loss. WA has today reported another drop in daily COVID-19 cases, recording 6,649 new infections. Four historical COVID-related deaths have also been recorded. There are 317 people in hospital with the virus, including 10 in intensive care. And the Australian Nursing Federation's State Secretary, Mark Olson, has announced his retirement after more than 23 years in the role. He was first elected to the post in November 1998 and says he has won six elections within the union since then. Mr. Olson says nurses have not lost a single condition during his time at the helm. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. 29-1.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Great to have you along this afternoon. Just before the news at 1, off to Mushay for the results of the cattle market with Tracy Kilner. And you'll spend a little bit of time on the Abrolhos Islands, where there is some beautiful, unique coral that's being farmed for aquariums right across the country. These are the ones that some people lucky enough to have one of those beautiful homes with a huge aquarium in them. Really try and find that unique coral to make their aquarium stand out from everyone else's. And also GrainCorp, the big grain storage and handling company on the East Coast, has launched a carbon farming project for its growers. You'll learn more about that shortly. Right now, it is off to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Joey Rawson is with you this afternoon. Joey, why don't we start in northern and eastern parts, because there has been quite a bit of rain through the Pilbara, which we spoke about earlier here on the Country Hour, but is there some more on the way?
Yeah, there is certainly some more on the way, Belinda. We've got this cloud band that's in play, and it's basically stretching across the Pilbara and into the southwestern parts of the Kimberley. So looking at the radar and satellite imagery, there's kind of two patches of the rain. One patch coming into that sort of Broome and south area, and another patch just through Port Hedland and a little bit east of Port Hedland through De Grey and moving towards Willow Down. So certainly the potential for some significant falls out of that rain band, and as a result, Belinda, we've got a severe weather warning out for that area. So it stretches basically from Roeburn all the way up to Cape Levique, and that is for heavy rainfall, and we're expecting the heaviest rainfall just to be on the coast, and as the cloud band moves inland, the rainfall will be slightly less.
And can you give us some idea of the sort of falls you're expecting?
Yeah, so we're not ruling out some pretty big falls, Belinda. So through that area, coastal locations, Roeburn through to Cape Levique, looking at 100 to 150 millimetres today with the possibility of getting some 200 millimetre falls. So today is certainly a significant day as far as rainfall goes, and those sort of numbers we expect with tropical cyclones. So it is quite unusual for this time of year. And then as we progress on to tomorrow, the rain over the Pilbara should ease a fair bit, so looking at 20 to 50 millimetres over the Pilbara, but the cloud band will be pushing towards the Kimberley, so looking at a bit more rain over the Kimberley, so looking at around 40 to 80 millimetres through parts of the Kimberley, Fitzroy Crossing and Broome has a potential, and Derby with potential for the odd fall of around 100 millimetres through that area, and also through parts of the Northern Gascoyne tomorrow, as we see another cloud band develop further to the west. So there is a potential for some decent falls in the northern and northeastern parts of the Gascoyne, with possible falls getting up to 80 millimetres. So a fair bit of rain around, Belinda.
It certainly sounds like it. Are there any more details beyond that area, Joey, in other northern parts and eastern parts?
Yeah, so the key is this cloud band is moving out to the east. So the Pilbara will be basically cloud-free or rain-free by Wednesday. And it's then got to remain over the Kimberley for many days. It's going to be quite stationary for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But the rainfall amounts coming out of that cloud band from Wednesday are certainly going to be less. But it will be raining for many days over the Kimberley.
All right. And is there much rain getting into the Southwest Land Division this week?
Not a lot of rain. We do have a bit of a southerly flow along the south coast, so we're certainly going to get some odd showers on the south coast today. Tomorrow, not a lot, just the odd showers along the south coast, 0 to 1 millimetres. And then as we get to Wednesday, we do have a cold front that is approaching. So Wednesday night, that front should be on the Capes. It's only a weak to moderate front, so we're not expecting a lot of rain out of that, and not a lot of rain to penetrate inland on Thursday as that sweeps through. So it'll really just impact the south coast as it brushes along the south coast.
And how are the temperatures?
They're pretty cold. So, cold conditions throughout a broad area of the state with the southerly flow that we've had behind this system that's moving over southeastern Australia at the moment.
All right. And then this afternoon, you did mention warnings earlier, but can you just recap those for us?
Yeah. So the biggest warning is this severe weather warning for the Pilbara and Kimberley for heavy rainfall. And that will continue through today and tomorrow. We do have a flood watch for the Pilbara coastal waters. And there's also a gale warning for the coastal waters on the Pilbara coast and strong wind warnings for the West Kimberley coast, the Ningaloo coast, and also the Eucla coast. So a fair few warnings at the moment.
Sure is. Joey, thank you so much for all those details. 23 to 1. Richard Hudson is here now to take a look through the rainfall figures over the weekend.
Yeah, so these are the figures from 9 a.m. on Friday right through to 9 a.m. this morning. In the Kimberley, Mandurah 6, that's the only one worth reading out. But in the Pilbara, Bonnie Down 6, Chila Plains 19, Coolawonya 112, De Grey 42, Exmouth 136, Glenflorie Station 15, Indy 142, Carrageenie North 27, Karratha 112, Learmonth 30, Marble Bar 47, Mardi 120, Mount Florence 117, Mount Stewart 34, Onslow 90, Paraburdoo 12, Pardoo 26, Port Hedland 96, Red Hill Station, which is just south of Panawanica, 152, Sherlock 141, Telfer 7, Warrambie 96, Warrawagine 43, Wailoo 27, Yaleen 100, Yarralula 145 and Yarri 60. So that's some great rain for the Pilbara. In the Gascoyne region, Bulloo Downs 9, Dalgetty Downs 6, Minina 10, Mount Vernon 13, Ned's Creek 7, Three Rivers 5 and Williambre 48. In the interior, Granite Peak and Warburton both recorded 5, Lorna Glen recorded 17 and Prenti Down 7. And then in the Goldfields, Laverton recorded 5 mils. A little bit around in the Eucla district as well, Eucla itself 15, Eyre 7, Forest 5 and Red Rocks Point just near the border 22 mils. And heaps out on the islands, Barrow Island 102, Thevenard Island 126, Varanus Island 199. Blimey, nearly cracked the 200. That is a huge amount of rainfall. A little bit around in the Southwest Land Division forecast districts, but nothing over 1 mil in the Central West and nothing over 3 mils in the Lower West. And then in the Southwest, Beetle Up 8, Cape Naturalist 9, Carlotta 7, 4 Acres 5, Carriedale 6, and Manjimup had 8 to 11 mils across a number of locations. Millianup 7, Northcliffe 7 as well, Pemberton 9 mils over 4 days, Quinnanup 8, Scott River 6, Shannon 8, Walpole Forestry 13 and Yanmar 8. Then in the southern coastal region, Albany recorded 10 to 14 mils, Beaumont West 11, Bremer Bay 13, Shane Beach 13, Dalyup Park 14, Denbarker 11, Denmark 13 to 16, Erinair 11, Esperance 8 to 11 mils, Gardner 9, Hopetoun 13, Jacob 6, Kimberley 15, King River 14, Metla 5, Mount Barker 8, Mount Howick 20, Munglin Up West 7, Oakmarsh Farm 12, Pleasant Valley 10, Tamar 8, Tallina Downs 11, The Duke 18, Warrajarra 9 and Wellstead 5. Nothing worth reading out in the Central Wheat Belt. And then in the Great Southern District, nothing over 2 mils. But Bell, just quickly, the big footy news over the weekend, I'm assuming you know what it is.
The come from behind win.
I'm not even going to brag. There's even bigger news than that.
Oh.
Because the Mullawar Saints won their first game in 3 years in the Great Northern Footy League. That's all down to them having a fantastic back line. They beat Northampton by 15 points. Northampton, as you know, renowned for being an AFL footy player factory. And the club president for the Mullawar Saints puts it all down to getting people on the training track. They had 40 and they had 30 girls as well, so they had 70 at training. But the big news today is Northampton have called for a national inquiry into how on earth Mullawar managed to get 70 people onto the training track. Personally, I think it's simple. What used to get Magpie, Gherkin, Sterling, Sticker, Butch and Flopper down to training at Beverley was just party pies. It's not that hard, really. 70 at training, though. That's incredible.
Mm. Thank you for that enlightenment, Richard. Appreciate that. 19 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And a couple of supporters, too, for the ban on flights to Indonesia. This has been suggested by a leading livestock analyst, Simon Quilty, from Global Agri Trends, who says just with foot and mouth disease in Indonesia at the moment, he says those flights to Indonesia should be, well, on hold until Indonesia can get FMD under control. This from Lindsay and Mulyabini. Yes, on people, travel stopped to Indonesia, including Bali. So there's a vote for that. And Shirley says ban all travels to those countries immediately until foot and mouth is eradicated there, or else our livestock industry will be grossly affected. 0448 922 604 to text through and have your say. Do you know what sets apart a serious home aquarium from just your amateur fishbowl with a few pebbles thrown in the bottom of it? Well, Andrew and Tracy Basili says it's coral. For 10 years, they've been coral farmers at the southern Abrolhos Islands, growing up to 90 species for the aquarium market. It's a long game. Coral can take 6 or 7 years to grow to saleable pieces, but their patience and determination is finally paying off. Andrew and Tracy say there are thousands of aquarium operators in Australia alone who are keen to get their hands on a special piece of premium WA coral.
We did a rough count probably 18 months ago. If we were to cut everything to a marketable size on the farm, there's 1.5 million, maybe 2 million pieces of coral out there now of a marketable size. There's a lot of product there and it's growing exponentially, so it's nice to leave it in the water until we obviously need it. Yeah.
It's a good holding paddock.
It is. Absolutely, yeah.
How many different types of coral are you growing here?
We are licensed for, I think it's about 90 species.
Wow. But our main ones are about 6 species.
Yeah. So the Abrolhos has a couple of species here that are found anywhere else, the purple acropola and Abrolhos sensis, so they are highly sought after. So they're a couple of unique species of coral from here that do very well in the marketplace. So we have a lot of nice blues and purples which sell well, and they're reasonably hardy corals.
So what's the most popular coral?
Purple acropora, yeah, and purple montipora is quite well, and then there's an acropora with a very long polyp extension too. That sells very well. So anything that's bright and colourful and has a lot of polyp extension is what's sought after in the aquarium trade.
So you're turning over tens of thousands of these pieces of coral. Who is buying them?
The main markets are around Australia and they're aquarium enthusiasts. And the really good enthusiasts like to have the marine tanks, and it's like a chemical experiment, basically. If you can keep a good piece of coral, you're doing really, really well in your aquarium. But to be able to get to that stage, it's like a chemical experiment to keep it in your own home.
And there's enough of these people to sustain.
Yeah. Surprisingly, yes. When we first started, we went, oh, that's not that big a market. Oh, well, we'll give it a go. There are thousands of people around Australia that love doing their aquariums in their own home and have such a passion that they will spend lots of money to be able to have that in their own home.
For bragging rights.
Yes. A saltwater aquarium is very challenging.
Yeah.
It's very, very challenging.
And I think that's why people like to do it, because it is a challenge. And then they fall in love with that.
You've been growing coral here for a while. You're at the point now where you feel like you've got it down pat, the processes. But has it been a hell of a journey to get to this point?
Absolutely.
A big learning journey.
Yeah.
So, as I was telling you before, we've worked really, really hard. There's been no holidays and things, and our kids have been involved with it as well. So they've seen us persist and persist, and now they can see at the stage where all that persistence and not so many holidays and things has kind of paid off, and now we're in a good position.
It's got us where we want to be. So, and yes, look, I think I must have changed technique with Tracy on coral propagation about 50 times, I think. So you look back from our first day, we've been granted a license, a exemption to get a little tiny bit of broodstock, and we were all really excited. And I think seven has took 3 hours to do 20 pieces, and we were really happy about that. And you extrapolate it out and we think, well, hang on, we're going to have to get a hell of a lot faster here to do it.
Yeah.
And through technology and technique, you can do it. You can make it viable, but still you've got a coral takes time to grow.
It does, but
it takes time to grow.
Sometimes Andrew will wake up in the morning and go, I've got this fantastic idea. And I go, oh, my goodness, what now?
Bloody hell, no.
I just roll my eyes at him and say, well, okay, let's have a go at it, see how it goes.
So lots of trial and error.
Lots of trial and error, and manufacturing things that aren't available on the market to be able to find something to use that is useful within our coral farm that nobody else has made before.
What's been the most difficult obstacle that you've had to overcome?
I think freight, but getting freight from a regional airport is a huge one, just because if you can't freight it anywhere, then you can't sell it.
Because there's conditions around that. The coral is alive.
Yes.
So it has
to
move.
So it needs to be sent out live in water. So it has to come from the Abrolhos to Geraldton, from Geraldton to Perth, and then from Perth to the rest of Australia or the world. And it has to be done within a time frame before the coral dies.
Yeah.
So it has been a very big challenge to do that. And nobody tells. There's no handbook to say, look, this is how you do it. You have to work it out for yourself.
Mm.
And that is one of the biggest challenges.
I wanted to ask the beginnings of all of this. You're at the point now where it's working, but what made you think in the very first place that we might try and grow some coral and sell it?
Just as a fisherman, commercially fishing all those years, you'd see coral growing, and you always thought the coral took so long, which it does. But commercially fishing, you'd see where a pot had been on the reef and there was a couple of scratches and marks and around the island. And then you go back for the following lobster season, everything would be nice and neat and clean, and channels down the reef would be slowly growing over, and you think, And then obviously having an avid passion for fish tanks and stuff, you try and marry it all up and you think, ooh, hang on, there could be some form of an opportunity here. Obviously, you hear about coral bleaching and reef dyeing and all sorts of stuff. Our reefs here are in very good shape. We're lucky in a pristine environment. The government was happy enough to let us have a go, so off we went.
You mentioned about reef rehabilitation and some of the corals here being used for that. Is that happening now, or is that coming, do you think?
I think in the near future it will, yeah. We're in a good place temperature-wise, and we now have enough volume of stock for reef rehabilitation. We've got our techniques now where we can grow masses of coral if it's so needed.
Coral farmers Andrew and Tracy Basili with Joe Prendergast. And coral isn't the only thing keeping the Basilis busy. They're also crayfishers, and they run a tiling business on the mainland in Geraldton. Do check out the gorgeous photos and even a short video of the coral farm online. Search ABC Coral Farm to have a look at Joe's story. 11 minutes to one. One of Australia's largest grain storage and handling companies, GrainCorp, has paired with a soil technology company to start a carbon farming project for its growers. The pilot program is using seed treatment to increase soil carbon on barley and canola crops in New South Wales and Victoria. Tegan Nock works for Loam Bio, which is the soil technology company involved in the project.
So our seed treatments are based on endophytic fungi, and they're fungi that are beneficial for plant species, but we've selected the right kind of fungi that's then able to actually increase the amounts of carbon within soils. But not only that, it's increasing the stable proportion of carbon within our soils. So they're applied as a direct seed treatment. It's planted out with the seed in furrow. They're forming a relationship with those plants, and then through that season, increasing the amounts of carbon that are being stored through that growing season.
So how long does it take to see results?
Yeah, so we've done a lot of extensive field trialing work now over the last few years. We've planted over 150 small plot trials across both Australia and North America. The results that we're seeing are pretty promising. So we're looking at around an average of 5% increase in total organic carbon through a growing season, which is relating then to around 2 tonnes of total organic carbon overall per hectare within soils.
What's the cost to farmers for the seed treatment?
So under this pilot year, there's no cost to growers. Obviously, we'll work through what the design looks like, but we're really trialling the ways that we can establish that program. So in this initial year, no cost to growers. Hearing a lot of the conversation and the messages that are coming through more broadly about the need to be able to adopt new technologies and new practices to enable us to make the most of the opportunity that is carbon farming and I guess the coming carbon markets. So growers are seeing this as a way for them to be able to, at least in the first instance, trial out some of those new technologies and really think about what that then means for their business in terms of diversifying revenue. So really positive response so far and really enjoying working with the growers that we are. It's obviously quite new technology and new approaches. So it's a learning for all of us, but really, really positive response from growers so far.
GrainCorp's Jesse Scott says he hopes all of the company's thousands of growers take part in some kind of carbon farming project in the next few years. He says this program is not about pushing farms to go carbon neutral, but to help farmers produce more carbon credits.
The growers kind of get two benefits out of this. They obviously get the yield benefits as one, but two, they get carbon credits. And how they use those carbon credits, I think, will be one of the big decisions they will face. They can do two things. They can either attach it to the crops themselves, which is what you call an inset, where you can sell it as a carbon neutral grain, or they can take the carbon credit and sell it on the open market to tech companies or other corporates around the world. I think that's a big question the growers will face over the coming months and years, what to do with those credits and where can they get the best financial returns. Some of them may choose to keep the credits for themselves and try and become carbon neutral as a growing enterprise.
What role do you see carbon farming playing in the grains industry, say, in the next 10 years?
A lot of the focus in Australia around carbon, I think, has been on projects like reforestation. One of the reasons why we're so excited by Loam is it's a carbon project that supports the broadacre growing that is already happening. It's not in conflict. Growers aren't having to make a choice between trees or planting crops. And so this is a way for our growers to effectively produce, in some ways, a second harvest. So every year they're going to harvest the usual crops. They're kind of wheat and barley and canola and whatever they're doing. But suddenly, through participation in these projects with Loam, they're going to have a second crop of carbon credits. Now, the benefit of that is pretty straightforward. It means you have a diversified earning stream that is delivering returns in good years and bad years. So it's a way for growers to diversify their earning and put in place a bit of a buffer to make sure they have earnings year in, year out.
So do you see carbon farming being a significant player in the grains industry in the future?
I hope that every one of our 11,000-odd growers is taking part of one of these projects in the next couple of years. I don't think it's ever going to replace them as their primary source of revenue on their farm, but it's going to be a very nice second revenue stream there. And the farmers who, I think, take part in it and manage their carbon well are going to find it is a natural, not a hedge, but buffer against droughts or rains or kind of all these seasonal impacts we're seeing.
And carbon farming has been an emerging industry for a few years now. I guess what's motivating GrainCorp to be involved now?
You're right. Carbon farming has become such a topic over the last couple of years. One of the things we're seeing and we're hearing from our growers is somewhere between curiosity and interest about this growing market, but a lot of uncertainty on who they should go with, what project they should follow, what methodology they should follow. There is so much competing information out there. So we're trying to pick the best one for our growers because, as I said, a grower that is producing more product more happily, more profitably is great for GrainCorp's core business.
Jesse Scott, he is GrainCorp's Chief Innovation and Growth Officer, speaking to Annie Brown about a carbon farming pilot project taking place on 1,500 hectares of barley and canola crops across New South Wales and Victoria. 5 minutes to one. Well, farmers in the north of Australia are hoping some research being done in the Kimberley's Ord Valley will show they can reduce nitrogen fertiliser inputs without seeing significant production drops. The Northern Australia Crop Research Alliance is doing the trials on maize crops near Kununurra. Agronomist Jack Daniel says initial results have been surprising, and so he's hopeful they will end up helping reduce fertiliser costs.
The assumption typically has always been that you start the year after a wet season with a blank canvas, and that is that any nitrogen remaining from the previous crop has leached or disappeared. But what we've found, and it's very encouraging through sampling across the valley, is that N levels are actually typically higher than what we've anticipated.
So what does that mean for growers here?
So last year we got no yield response above our lowest rate of N, which was 200 units, and that was because there was quite a lot of mineral N in the soil profile prior to planting. It potentially means there's a window of opportunity to reduce our N inputs, but we need to generate as much data as possible so the growers have confidence to implement an altered N regime.
So can you tell us how you're exploring that further this year?
Yeah, so this year we're actually going on to a cotton stubble because that's going to be a likely rotation going forward is maize after cotton. And we want to see how much N the cotton stubble will provide to the subsequent maize crop and get the optimum rate of N for that maize crop.
What sort of fertiliser inputs are growers putting on maize?
Maize is a pretty nutrient-hungry crop, and that's because you'll have 25 tonnes of dry matter to a hectare in a good yielding crop, which equates to a bit over 300 units of N. But what we're trying to do is get as much N as we can from the soil rather than applying synthetic fertilisers.
And what's the best case scenario with these results? How much do you think we could potentially reduce the fertiliser inputs there?
I dare say we'll need fertiliser inputs. That won't change. I would love to say reduce it by a third. That's your nitrogen. So that would be a great result.
NACRA agronomist Jack Daniels speaking about a trial that could lead to Ord Valley growers cutting back on their fertiliser costs. And NACRA is the Northern Australia Crop Research Alliance, and the GRDC and the University of Queensland are also involved in that work. 3 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. The Liberals and Nationals named their leadership teams in the wake of the federal election. Retail politics, from sales assistant to Member of Parliament, a Greens MP from Queensland gets ready to take up his seat in Canberra. And a young Australian cyclist wins Italy's most famous race. Jai Hindley secures victory only 2 years after narrowly missing out. Those stories and more coming up this lunchtime on The World Today.
2 minutes to one. 550 head of cattle were yarded at Mouchet's market today, so 400 less than last week. Tracy Kilner is at the sale yard. Can you run through the prices, Tracy?
Prices fluctuated on quality with an upward trend in most categories, mainly due to the low numbers of stock on offer. Wiener steers sold to 600 cents, while restockers paid up to 605 cents for Angus wiener heifers. Heavy prime cows gained, selling to a top of 340 cents, while bulls again dominated the numbers offered, with all categories finishing up on last week. The local bred wiener steers sold from 580 to 600 cents, heifers made from 448 to 605 cents. Yearling steers made from 550 to 580 cents for the local bred lines, and from 320 to 450 cents for pastorals. Yearling heifers returned 368 to 520 cents for local breds, and from 270 to 360 cents for the pastoral heifers. Grown steers, including pastorals, made from 336 to 554 cents to processors, and from 318 to 490 cents to feeder buyers. A small run of grown heifers sold from 358 to 360 cents a kilo. Heavy prime cows gained 2 cents, selling from 292 to 340 cents, while the medium weight cows gained 28 cents, selling from 2.92 to 3.36 cents a kilo. Store cows made sold to processors for 2.36 to 2.96 cents, and feeder buyers paid from 2.52 to 300 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls sold for 2.48 to 350 cents. Medium weights returned 2.62 to 350 cents, depending on quality, while the lightweight bullies made from 2.76 to 580 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you so much, Tracy. Time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.